Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to pick up where we were last time. But first, before I start, so there's a homework due on Friday, which most of you seem to have noticed. Is there any questions about that? Or general, which I could answer now? Everyone, I assume most people have started it, because if not, that could be a problem. No? Okay, so I assume everyone feels okay or at least has a question that they can't ask without like showing code or something. So last time we looked at several memory management problems, and we had this common theme where we had these vulnerabilities which were based on just having two things with different purposes end up at the same memory location for various reasons. We also looked at some ways to cause buffer overflows, like integer arithmetic problems, like not checking that multiplies wrap around, which gives us buffer overflows despite code which is supposed to do length checking, which tells you why these things happen a lot. It's not that programmers don't even know about it. They check that they're not exceeding the length of the buffer. They aren't silly, but it's actually pretty hard to write those checks and pretty rare to actually test them. And we started format string exploits, where basically the attacker gets to tell printf what to do. And sort of the basic format was that someone wrote code where they decided, the print function, I don't need to put it all in one big printf call. I can just call printf and then call printf with the string I want to put in the middle, and then call printf again. And it turns out if you do this, you're in a lot of trouble. And a lot of real software did something like this. I know that there are other patterns which are less obvious, like software which would use sprintf correctly and then use sprintf on the thing it didn't sprintf with before. So that's not the only way this happened, but generally just having a function which takes a format string like printf and calling it with user input instead of using something like %s. And we saw that the central problem with this is that this lets us actually read the stack and write to things based on addresses on the stack. And this is the reading the stack example. So we have, from the stack, the actual contents of our buffer, because it's on the stack, that we can read by just passing things to printf saying, hey, as your eighth argument, there's this unsigned long that I want you to print as hexadecimal. And printf will happily say, oh yeah, I know where the eighth argument goes, and it's in the middle of our buffer. So this let us like read stack canaries, but the real problem, the real reason why we really care about printf vulnerabilities is that printf has this little known flag, which turns out to be very important security-wise, which lets you write two things. Particular, it lets you record how much printf is printed out. So you can see why someone at some point thought that would be a useful thing to be able to get out of printf. Perhaps, maybe they regret that decision now, because this is pretty much all it's been used for, like rare exceptions. But it exists. And so we had this set up here, which I was going to demo today, which is, we have this unreachable exploited function, and I want to overwrite the global offset table entry for fgets to point to it. And what I was going to do was, this is the code like you're writing for the over assignment, which prints out the format string to do, which is, by the way, what you're going to do for our format string assignment. And there are two sort of things I need to shuffle around. But first, I needed to have the address as a pointer, just like you have the return address in your overflow assignment that you're overwriting as a pointer to the stack. Here I need to have the value of the pointer to the memory address I want to overwrite, which was this address here, this where fgets looks for the address to jump to. And in addition, I needed to write the appropriate number of characters beforehand, so when I use %n, it stored the value I wanted to store there. And the way I did this is that I can conveniently just say, yeah, I'd like to write an integer with 4 million characters, please. And this, in fact, does work. So if I do that and this window. So I have, here's our test program. And I've have my program which generates the exploit here. So this is format2exploit.c is exactly that program. And if I run format2exploit, I can look at what it outputs. So I'm going to run it through a print command called, you can't actually see this because it's way at the bottom of the screen, through od-c, which is, od stands for octal dumb, because hexadecimal is actually newer than octal, so they named it after octal at the time. And minus c means print as characters. So I'm going to print it out this way so I can see, show you the parts of it which aren't normal characters, like the address. That's not something that I could print out to my terminal and have make sense. So we'll see we have %c, I'll scroll this up, %c and so on, and then 497 the ULN, some question marks for padding, and then this is the address. It happens to be an ASCII-8 followed by octal 20, just not a printable character, followed by a backslash, followed by backslash zeros. And then I have a new line at the end because the program reads until a new line. Sure. I have a new line, the program reads into a new line. Actually, the program's gonna, it'll read into the new line. We have these zeros. Probably they were there before if we didn't write them. So that's what the program prints out, and I can just try to run it by, I can take its output, put it through a text file, and then I can run, what is it called? Test format 2, my program with that as input, just like we did with over. And we can see what happens. It takes a little bit because my terminal is not very fast at showing you 4 million zeros. But we actually see that we have the function in exploit, it got called. It got a little mixed in with the output of the printf, but it still got called, which is what we wanted. And I can actually clean this up by telling my shell to redirect to dev null the output that goes to standard out, because if we look at our exploited code, it prints to standard error. And so you can see more clearly that that's being run. But we printed out all this extra junk output, but that's fine because we got to do what we wanted to do. And we're the peer person who's getting the output, which is typically the case when you're attacking the program, so you don't care that you get back some junk as long as your exploit runs. But it is a bit slow to print out 4 million zeros. Not as slow when I'm at least not showing it on my screen. So what's an alternative we could do? How could we make this better? And yeah, our problem here is that %n is the only way to write something, and it only writes the number of characters we've written so far. So how can I construct, the address I want, which is about 4 million, without printing out a whole bunch of junk? Yeah, so we could write smaller values. And that's exactly what people tend to do in practice, is that they don't want to actually write, have 4 million zeros to print something out. And it's much worse if you wanted to, say, write an address which was like several billion. Like, you technically can tell printf to print out that much, but you'll probably be waiting for a while, even if you aren't displaying the output. So what you commonly will see is doing something where you write it with 2%ns. In this case, I'm using %hn to only write a short, but I could also not do that and just rely on one overwriting the other if I do things in the right order. So, I want to write a big number. I write it as 2 shorts. Note that I can do this in any order, so it doesn't matter if the lower or higher part, the lower or higher short comes first. So in this case, I'm gonna write the lower short to the lower address, but I can do, or I think, yeah, I flip. But I could write any number, I just need to order my addresses in the appropriate order. I think I swapped up here and here, but I can write any number, I just need to divide it into like 2 byte pieces, and I write a sequence of shorts. I use something like this to advance to the appropriate number, and then I have pointers to everything I want to write with that value, and I just sort the shorts I want to write in increasing order, and have those pointers in my string. So people look confused, so probably not explaining this correctly. Yeah.
I might have missed something, but how are you writing that number in that specific address? So like, as with the...
So how am I writing this number in... Is the question about how I'm choosing the number to write or choosing the address to write to?
The number that you're writing is just the last thing that you put in printf, right? Or...
The number that I'm... So printf is writing a number in this example because of this percent n. So whenever I put a percent n in my string, in my format string, like this percent hn, that tells it store to this pointer. I can store the number of things you've written so far to this output string to this pointer. And I can do that as many times as I want in the format string. So to which pointer? The pointer has to be where printf is expecting the next argument. So what I need to make sure that I've that I have enough stuff beforehand that I'm at a place on the stack where I've put this pointer. So first I'm going to skip over the registers, and then I'm going to take advantage of this to skip over the format, skip over anything else on the stack, like the return address of printf, anything like push to save stuff before printf, and the beginning of this buffer to get to where I put this address somewhere. So I'm going to position printf's looking for an argument such that it coincides with where I put a pointer.
So
we have to place that pointer ahead of time. And the usual strategy is going to be, like in this case, when I print out a whole bunch of arguments to printf, eventually some of them happen to be values from my buffer. And that's because printf is looking for arguments on the stack when it runs out of arguments that go in registers. And on the stack below where printf was called is my buffer. And so we're going to rely on that to be able to specify what the pointer values are. That we have our string is going to appear as part of printf's arguments. So part of constructing the format string exploit, you might like use a format string like this to figure out where in your string maps to what argument to printf. So for example, if I took this format string here, and instead of having %hn, I put %lx, I should see this one of these addresses if I did things right. And the reason I'll see that is because it's going to take part of my buffer and use that as an unsigned long. And if I can do that, I can use instead of %lx to print out the unsigned long, that's my address, I can use it to say store to that address. And that's sort of how I would set up this exploit. Yeah?
I'm a little confused with how splitting up the number would reduce the number of junk zeros. Is it because you're calling for more spaces? You're giving more opportunities to put things in the stack?
So the question is, why does splitting up the number mean you have less junk zeros to output? So in this case, I'm writing this an 8-byte thing, sorry, this should be a 4-byte thing, as two shorts. And when that's interpreted as a 4-byte number, that's going to be a much bigger number, right, than any of the shorts. And the number of junk zeros I have to print out is basically the value I am actually storing. So by only writing shorts, I never have to print out more than 64k zeros. And I can construct any value in 2-byte pieces. And that's the general strategy for doing these exploits, is that you never need to write up more than that. You can even like limit it to like 256 if you write in 1-byte pieces. Yeah. Yeah, they're just independent stores to different pointers because they're different arguments. And I guess something I'm not showing is I need to do some work to make these two addresses I have somewhere in my string to make sure that they ended up in the correct place in the string. Which was just a matter of saying, when I did %lx, what number was printed out? Where was that in my input? So that's some work the exploit writer had to do. They had to like figure out what was on the stack, where my buffer was on the stack, and make sure they positioned these pointers in the right place. So other questions, comments? Confusion. It's, I guess, not nearly as clear an explanation as I'd like. So I guess I have a demo set up, so I should illustrate it this way. So if we want to see, our exploit is this. So we can let's make a copy of this and we can see, and instead of using %ln, let's use %lx to print out the hexadecimal number that's at that address. And we should see the target address we did. And if we do that, I'll write to an output file because it's going to be 4 megabytes. And I don't want to read that. But if we do that, we read the output file. Sorry, I need to input from example.txt. That would be great. So if I read the output file after doing that and go to the end of the first line, the end of the giant line here, I see that in the middle of this, I have the number I printed out, but I also have, my editor is slow on a 4-meg file for some reason. I also have the address we were using, which was 601038 hexadecimal. So that was printed out in there. Because it was actually in the string. It was what was on the stack at that location where it was looking for an argument was that number. So what was printed out here is everything. Of course, glacial speed. So everything before this 6 is the percent %u value that was we had before our percent %ln, and everything and this 60183 is what was printed out for percent %lx, which we had as the pointer before. I just changed the n to an x so I could see what pointer am I trying to write to. And the rest of the string was those question marks I added as padding to make sure the pointer was in the right place. And the way I figured that out was actually just when I was constructing this exploit, I just put some pattern that I would recognize with %lx, and I used a %lx and saw, okay, where is this? And then I replaced it with %ln. Other questions? Hopefully this makes it clearer kind of what's happening. So the central idea is that we're relying on, just like we relied on confusion between like a freed object and an alkaline object, we're relying on confusion between whatever was on the stack, which is usually our buffer, and what would be printf's arguments. Okay. So as I mentioned, there's a format string assignment coming up next. It is probably easier than the overflow assignment, though. To make things easy, you don't have to do code injection like that example where you like inject a function pointer somewhere. We have a global variable for you to target that will be convenient. This also makes sure that we definitely don't depend on things which will vary between machines. More realistically, you do different things to implement it. You typically overwrite a known code pointer, like a global offset table entry or some other pointer, and then use something to take advantage of that to execute the code you wanted. Either you point to somewhere that's useful, or use a technique we'll learn later called return-oriented programming to have some string of useful code run. Or you somehow make a pointer to a buffer you know contains your code. All these techniques we learned about before. So that concludes our foray into various types of control hijacking exploits. So things that let us, as an attacker, decide what code gets run. And that's always bad, and there's a lot of ways this ends up happening. And there were things that needed to happen for most of these exploits to work. So usually, part of these exploits is that we need to know addresses in the program. But not always, we needed to insert code to run. And usually, but not always, we needed to overwrite an address of some action that pointed to code. And given this, that gives us some countermeasures against it, that we could construct against this. And we already saw one of them, which was stack canaries. And stack canaries were focused on this problem that the attacker needs to overwrite a code address. So we'll try to protect the code address from being overwritten and actually used. So stack canaries are what we saw. And there were various trade-offs that were made in having stack canaries. We only protected return addresses. And we saw that there's lots of techniques which don't care about return addresses. They overwrite something else. There's plenty of choices in real programs for things to overwrite that aren't return addresses. So that was a limitation of this technique. It protected against something that was valuable, but it didn't do anything. And it also was pretty good in that the compiler did it automatically for us, but it required us to recompile. If I have a vulnerable program today, I can't just make it use stack canaries. I need to rebuild it and hope it doesn't break. And also, we assumed that the attacker couldn't do certain things. So when the attacker can just read from the stack, like printf lets us do, they could just read out a stack canary. And that completely would defeat this protection. It also assumed that the attacker had to do a contiguous overwrite. Many of our overwrites were that way, but we saw when we could overwrite like a data pointer, we could ignore that restriction. So this is an imperfect technique, but it's useful. And we have this sort of compromise where we're doing something that's pretty cheap to do, that the compiler can do automatically, that helps a lot, but it doesn't really solve the problem. And in your overflow assignment, you saw another technique, mainly because you needed to turn it off, called address space randomization. And this is trying to stop not that someone could overwrite a code address, but it's trying to stop that other step of being able to guess program addresses. So the idea of address space randomization is that we're going to make it so you can't guess the addresses you need. And for your overflow assignment, this seems to make things really hard. You can't know what the stack address is. How are you going to do anything like stack smashing? But this had some assumptions that limit its applicability. So one assumption it has is that the program never leaks the address. Just like we assume the stack canary wouldn't be shown, if the program leaks an address, then we could probably defeat this. If we know something on the stack, we can figure out where everything else is on the stack, because it's just relative to that, we just do some arithmetic. So this is actually worse than stack canaries, because something which reads something that's not in a variable on the stack, that's pretty unusual. But something which leaks a pointer is not as uncommon. Because pretty much any pointer to the stack will give us the address of everything on the stack. And pretty much any pointer to anywhere will give us all the information we need. It also assumes, if you want to apply this to a program, that you can actually just change addresses in the program. And that's not always going to be possible. Because programs have hard-coded addresses. Like you see in object dump output, you see an address in the object dump output. And often you can't just move the program and expect it to work. Because like that address might be hard-coded in an instruction. So this technique, like stack canaries, is going to require, for some programs, a recompile if you want to apply it fully. So didn't do that for the stack, because we don't hard code the address of the stack in our program. Okay. Hopefully. Maybe we do, but hopefully we don't. So we're going to start with these mitigations and look at some other commonly actually deployed mitigations. I'm also going to talk a little bit about, hopefully, about some techniques which are not commonly deployed, but have been proposed in the research. And generally, when we're comparing this, there's like three questions I'd like you to think about. So one is, what does this mitigation assume the attacker can do? And often, this assumption is trying to scope our mitigation to work by getting rid of things that attackers often can do. Like stack canaries is assuming attackers can't read arbitrary spaces in memory. That's often not true, but that's the assumption they have. And stack canaries are assuming that if a buffer overflow or of some sort happens, that the attacker can't write location x plus 1 without writing location x. Which is often true, but sometimes not true. And that affects how good these mitigations are. The other big question is the effect on performance. And this matters because people really do not like turning on just-in-case mitigations if you tell them, I'm going to make your program 10% slower. And many good proposals for mitigations have that sort of problem. That they make the program 10% slower, or like 50% slower, and people who are writing C code to have things really fast, which is why they aren't doing bounds checking of arrays and things like that, which why they have these vulnerabilities, probably aren't going to be happy about you saying, yeah, I'm going to make your C code really slow. The other question is whether we can just apply them to existing software. So there's some proposals where, you know, we might break some programs. And that's not good. There's proposals where we have to recompile programs or we don't. And that affects whether you want to deploy it, whether you can deploy it. Because often, you get a library from someone, you don't want to rebuild it. Okay. So with these questions in mind, people have proposals for some brainstorming. What are good mitigations that we could have in addition to the ones we talked about? So we had stack canaries, and we had address space randomization. What are some other things we could do that would help deal with these exploits? So, yeah. So we could add bounds checking.
I should make a
so we could add bounds checking. Yeah. So address comparison. That being where? Okay. So how would we check? So I agree, address comparison, but to what? Okay, store a copy of the return address somewhere, like a backup copy. Okay. Other ideas? How about things that deal with like heap smashing? or, you know, vTable replacements. Are there things we can do for that? Yeah. Okay, so random spacing between heap objects. Okay, other ideas? Yeah. Yeah, so we mentioned this, that, you know, check count, free count in memory blocks, which is something that malloc implementations actually do. Yeah, get something? Input sanitization. So input filtering. So, you know, hopefully if we do input filtering, you can't put an address in a string, assuming addresses usually aren't just like normal printable characters. Okay, other ideas? Yeah.
So for the printf exploitation, is it usually common that people pass in a lot of parameters into it?
So the question is, for format string exploitation, do they usually have a lot of parameters? Generally, they use the minimum they need to. But how much that is depends on where the buffer is, right? If they need to advance, you know, 100 bytes to get to the buffer, that's going to be so many parameters. If they only need to advance like 16 bytes, that's going to be a smaller number of parameters. Just matters where they can put an address to write to.
Okay, not
address,
I just mean normal people
use it. Normal people use printf? Oh, okay, so you're saying how many parameters does printf calls usually have? More than 6 is common. I've probably seen code which has like 12 parameter calls to printf. But I guess, are you alluding to that maybe printf should not let you have past 16 parameters?
No, I was just wondering.
Okay. Yeah.
Do like user permission checking to prevent calling certain functions from like user?
Okay, so permission checking, meaning that like some programs shouldn't be able to call certain functions at all?
System function.
Okay. Permission checking. So program. Like start a shell command prompt. I have it in front of me. So, like for example, programs that are just like a web browser shouldn't be able to start a command prompt at all. Like that sort of thing. Yeah. So that's something we can do. Any other ideas? People out of ideas? Okay, so most of these are actually, many of these, I guess, not sure about some of them, but many of these are real things that software does, that people have done. So bounds checking, like Java does this. This is actually a bit challenging to add to C, and maybe in a future lecture we'll talk about how you add it to C. So the problem with adding it to C is that you want to add bounds checking to something like this, and that's a bit hard to do, because where do you get the size? It's not there. But you can do it in many cases. So that is something that compilers can do, is that they can say, oh, you have a buffer, static buffer, I can do all the checking I can to make sure you aren't overflowing that. So do in general. Yeah. So how does this do on our criteria? We had several criteria, one of which was, you know, first one of which was performance. How do you think this is for performance?
Not too bad, compiled.
So you think it's not too bad? Okay. What are we adding to the program?
If we're adding checks to the compiler, then it would all happen like at the start.
Okay,
so you never have to execute anything during runtime.
Okay, so the question, so your proposal is that we can do our bounds checking at compile time. We can just look at a function and say, this function doesn't exceed the bounds of this array. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Okay, any other opinions on performance overheads? Yeah. So if we had code that was inserted by the attacker that was running, yeah, it wouldn't check the bounds. But presumably if that happens, it's we already lost. Like, yeah, like the bounds checking was supposed to stop that. But I think there's a problem with this idea of doing it at compile time, is that sometimes we can't do that. Or it's not clear how we can do that, you know. So let's say we have, you know, less than, you know, we have code like this. Can you bounds check that? How do you bounds check that at a compile time? You need to know what get length does. If you have like, yeah. So often you could bounds check it at compile time, but sometimes you're not going to be able to. So this means that in general, you're going to need to insert some dynamic checks, but not all of that, always. Like sometimes you can just do it statically. And hopefully we'll talk about this later, but because you sometimes need dynamic checks, when you do need dynamic checks to do. So a good idea, a good mitigation is having the compiler insert whatever static checks it can. But often you do need dynamic checks, like most of the time, unfortunately. And those are way more expensive than you guess. And the problem is that the easiest way to write the dynamic checks is to do something like, if I is less than length of array here, which means you're checking every iteration of a loop, which ends up being very expensive. So typical overheads I've heard for techniques which do this sort of thing are like 10 to 50%. But it depends on the details, if you want to check everything. But if you only want to check convenient things, that's something you certainly can do. And compilers have explored doing a little of this. So address comparison. So we will talk about a technique which basically looks like storing a backup copy of the return address. That is a real thing that's done. So I don't know that people do random spacing between heap objects. Maybe, but it probably makes the allocator worse, which people like their malloc being fast. But a related thing you can do is you can do heap canaries, which are the same thing as stack canaries, but on the heap. You just have a magic value, a random value before your heap block, and you check that before you do linked list operations. We kind of memory block. So input filtering, I think, is something that people have done. This is a challenging mitigation from the perspective of, can I just apply it to a program? Because all these things we talked about here are just recompile, or in the case of, you know, heap canaries or random spacing of heap objects, just use a new C library, like not even recompile. But input filtering is tricky because you might break some programs if you just filter out non-ASCII characters. Maybe some programs are silly and read their binary files that way. So that's a trickier technique to actually apply in general. But it is a real mitigation that people might want to do, is that make fgets not return funny characters. Problem is that someone somewhere probably used fgets to write binary files. Read binary files. And permission checking, so it's making it so programs can't do things they're not supposed to do. This is a real thing. This is known as sandboxing. The idea is that you're putting the program in a sandbox where they can't harm anything. And this is a commonly used technique, especially for example, components of web browsers. And we might talk about how this works later in the semester. So this technique, it's actually very efficient, but it is much less generic. If you want to implement sandboxing, you can't just recompile your program, because I can't look at a program and say, what things is this supposed to do easily? Especially because one of the things you want to control is like what files is it supposed to be able to write. So typically to do that, someone needs to look at the program and say, what is this program supposed to do, which is a lot more effort than just recompiling. This is a very effective mitigation, because who cares if the attacker can run arbitrary code if that code can't do anything dangerous? Okay, so any comments on any of these mitigations before we move on to some real examples and explore things? Okay, so yeah. So we have all these mitigations you came up with, which follow the typical pattern of mitigations, which is that they usually attack the exploit and not the vulnerability. In a few cases, we really attack the vulnerability, like bounce checking, but most of them were more about, you know, that we're still gonna let the memory problem happen. We're just gonna not do something as bad, you know. We're gonna do something that's a little better. And the stack canary is sort of a classic example of this. We still let the return address be overwritten, we just don't do anything with the overwritten value. So we saw the return address before, which is based on adding a little bit of code and a little bit of memory to the stack. So there's an alternate idea, which is related to this, which works even if you have information disclosure, assuming that you can only do a contiguous buffer overwrite. And this is something called shadow stacks. And it's basically the technique that mentioned of just storing a backup copy of the return address somewhere else. So what we'll do is we'll have two stacks. We'll have a stack for the return addresses and a stack for all the data. If you do an overwrite on the stack for the data, you can't change the return addresses because they're not near each other. And this is something the compiler can just do. You can just change how we return from functions and call functions to use this second, to switch over to this other stack and then switch back. So what do people think about this technique? Does this seem good, bad? How about performance? How would you think this would affect performance? Yeah. Yeah, so this should make things a little slower, mainly because we need to store this stack pointer somewhere. And that's going to give us less space to store other things, or at least in registers at least. If we have it in a register, we have to like copy it from memory and back. So that seems like a little bit of a cost. Yeah, you got a comment? Yeah. So like stack canaries, the overhead is just based on how often do we have to return from functions. And if it's not often, this is not going to be so bad. A difference with stack canaries is that with stack canaries, we can control the overhead by only putting stack canaries where it matters. That doesn't really work for this technique. So how about as far as compatibility goes? Is this good from a compatibility perspective? Is it easy for me to take a program and apply this technique to it if I have a compiler that supports shadow stacks? Yeah?
If you have a lot of pass values, could it break it? Is it about to like, be passing things on the stack that would have been in registers previously?
So you're worried that we might have might change the calling convention and have less registers to store arguments?
Yeah.
So if we have to do that, that's going to be a performance problem. I'm asking about compatibility. Is there any like compatibility concerns? Like how compatible is this with existing programs? Like from a correctness point of view. Yeah.
I'm sure someone somewhere manipulates their return address to like do cheap jumps or something.
Yeah, so maybe you're worried that someone has some code which depends on the return address being where it is. And you're thankful for cheap jumps, but there's one case I can think of where I'd have code which depends on the return address being where it is, and that's if I wrote some assembly. If I wrote assembly, I'm going to have problems here because I changed the calling convention. So if I have existing assembly functions, they're not going to work anymore. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, that's another problem. So just like I broke assembly because I changed the calling convention, external libraries that don't know about this, I can't use anymore. And that makes this technique, even though it's fairly efficient, really unattractive. But it's one that's commonly talked about in the research literature because it's pretty elegant. You just have a second stack, and you know, it doesn't matter how clever your overflow is, as long as you're staying within this main data stack, you're never going to touch a return address. Okay. So that's another example of sort of that's an example of the sort of our backup copy of the return address is elsewhere where it's safe from overflows. And that's something we could also apply to things like vtable pointers and other things like that. And people have made proposals of that sort, though I don't think any of them are widely deployed. As far as I know, stack canaries are sort of the widely deployed technique, which is besides heap canaries, stack and heap canaries are the widely deployed techniques for detect a pointer being overwritten or keep it away. Besides things we'll talk about later, like address space randomization, which kind of keeps pointers from being overwritten. Okay. So there's another category of protection mechanisms, which none of you actually really mentioned. Well, I guess you alluded to it with sandboxing. Sandboxing is keep the program from touching things it shouldn't. So there's something kind of similar, which is that the OS can control what the program can do. And there's a whole bunch of mitigation mechanisms which are going to be based on having the hardware or operating system protections work for us. And the key thing we're going to take advantage of is not controlling what files you can write and things like that, but controlling what memory you can access. And controlling where things are in memory. So this is address space randomization and related techniques. And the idea is that since the exploit, we'll try to access memory that's not valid, and that's a seg fault. So our hope is that we can turn exploits into seg faults. And if you recall, I briefly mentioned, and you'll learn at the end of 3330, or have learned, that there's this notion of virtual memory, which is that we take a program's address, and the OS gets to decide what addresses correspond to what real parts of memory. I'm going to give a very brief introduction to the parts which matter for this class about this mapping. So there's this mapping that's set up where the operating system gets to decide what memory addresses you can use. And this is actually very powerful for doing exploit mitigations. We can control what happens when the program goes outside the bounds of its buffers. But unfortunately, there are limitations. So the way the mapping essentially works is that there's this big table that's stored in a more compact way than this, where we have contiguous ranges of addresses and permissions and where they actually are in real memory. And this table has entries which are ranges of addresses and units known as a page. And a page is typically 4 kilobytes. If you want to set permissions on less memory, we can't do it, not with these mechanisms. But these mechanisms, despite that limitation, are very attractive because they're very, very fast. The processor is designed to do them all the time on every memory access, and there's no performance penalty, essentially. And typically, we'll be able to say, is something readable and is something writable? So this is the mechanism which is why segfaults happen, why you can't just write to some memory somewhere. Instead, you've got a segfault. And one thing we commonly want to do for these memory errors, what we'd really like to happen, is instead of the buffer overflow resulting in us overwriting the return address, we'd like the buffer overflow to just result in a segfault. You know, segfaults aren't good, but they're way better than the attacker deciding what code gets to run. So how can we make that happen, given that this is the sort of mapping we can set up? What can we do? Yeah. Yeah, so we could set up, if we just set up one of these entries so it's not readable, and we put that next to our buffer, then overflowing that buffer will try to read or write that not readable space. And this is something we could actually do. So we have a buffer on the stack, and we have a return address for a function. Instead of having a stack canary, we could have what is known as a guard page. So we could have something where there's an entry in this table which says it's not readable or writable, and there's this gap between the buffer and the return address which is not readable or writable. Whenever the program overflows this buffer, it's going to segfault every time. No matter how clever the attacker is, as long as the attacker can't, has to do a contiguous write. So this is something we could really do. And it's an attractive option, but it's generally not done. So you can see one problem here, which is that because this is a 4 kilobyte range, that if we did this, then every time we called a function with a buffer, we'd have to allocate an extra 4 kilobytes of space, address space at least. It doesn't have to have a real memory address, but we'd have to add an extra 4 kilobytes. And a bigger issue than the amount of memory addresses we're using is that you have to call the OS to do this. That programs aren't allowed to change this table directly because that would let them also access memory of other programs, which you don't want to let them do ever. So they actually have to call the OS to do this. And this would mean that every time you call a function, you need to make a system call to the OS to change this table. And in addition to the time to call the OS to do things, changing this table is not super fast. So there's reasons that we don't actually do this in reality, but this would be a valid and working strategy for protecting against it, protecting against buffer overflows, and the overhead for checking the writes is essentially zero, but the overhead for setting it up is pretty high. Yeah?
Can you choose like certain parts of your program to do it? So say you have one space that you know there.
Yeah, so we could do this selectively. We could like have some functions set up this guard page and some not, and that would limit the overhead. I think the main reason it hasn't been done in, so I guess the two big reasons it hasn't been done in practice, so one is probably just that the that stack canaries are seem to be good enough compared to this technique, and another is that that even for cases where you might want to like automatically identify functions to do this, it's probably still pretty high overhead to go to the operating system before and after the function. Because that probably takes like tens of microseconds, which is a lot of time relative to how fast even a function that has like 1,000 byte buffers is. Yeah, so we could add that. Yeah, I haven't seen people do it, but this is something you could conceptually do. I guess the other issue is that commonly people do not like their stack being many megabytes, and this would make that probably happen. But it's something you could do. Now, I told you that guard pages typically aren't done for like protecting the stack return addresses on the stack, but they are actually very common in practice. And the big case where they're used is for heap allocations that are very large. So something that a very paranoid heap allocator can do is that you could put a guard page on both sides of something you malloc. And there is a real allocator called Electric Fence, which you can still download, which does this for every single allocation. Now, it wasn't intended to prevent people from exploiting things. The nice thing about this is that if you go over the end of this buffer by one byte, you will get a segfault. And for debugging off by one errors and things like that, that's great. So it's your allocations are a lot slower with that. And this wastes a lot of space here if you do this for like even very small allocations, but this reliably detects buffer overflows with pretty low overhead besides that malloc is now slower. So as I said, Electric Fence was something that did this for every allocation. So real allocators don't do this for every allocation, but commonly will do it for very large allocations. Because if you're allocating like a megabyte buffer, it's pretty free to add two pages to it, add 8 kilobytes to it, in order to make it so that if you overflow the buffer, nothing bad happens. Yeah?
Why is the meter on both sides? Can you overwrite upwards?
So the question is, why do we have a guard page on both sides? Anyone have a guess as to why we do that? Yeah? Okay, so if everyone, so you're right, but the reason we would have one below is that we want to reliably detect if there's a buffer underflow. And conceptually, yes, there could be something else right here. This could also, this guard page could double as the above the thing guard page for the next thing, for another allocation. That would be common. Yeah. So the question is, why do we have 4 kilobyte pages? So there are systems which have had different page sizes, but this is related to the overhead of the hardware that implements this and the size of the table. So there's a compromise made there when you choose the page size, and people have generally, probably these days, think that 4K is a little small as far as that overhead goes. So it's not likely to get smaller just because the space the table takes up and the amount of time the hardware needs to spend to actually implement this mechanism, amount of resources, depends on that size. Yeah, up there. Yes. Well, so the space we allocate, so this space from the bottom of the guard page to the top of the guard page has to be a multiple of the page size, which is another reason we're wasting even more space.
So, you mean that you can't
have the pages exactly, you can't necessarily detect exact overflow? So the question is, because they can't be multiples, does that mean we can't detect exact overflows? So in this case, we're detecting exact overflows by positioning the buffer right up the end of the buffer against a page. But the compromise is by being detecting overflows exactly, we do not detect underflows exactly. And that's a fundamental problem. Yeah, you can do one, the other, or not both. And Electric Fence chose to do this because that's usually the problem you have is an overflow, not an underflow. So, yeah, as I said, Electric Fence was built for debugging into this. Real allocators do it for very large allocations, like, you know, at least megabytes, or maybe hundreds of kilobytes, they'll add guard pages because it's fairly cheap there. But they won't do it for typical small allocations because that would waste a lot of space. If you allocate 160 bytes, you don't want the allocator to actually use 4K to do that, which is what you have to do if you add guard pages. Okay, so we looked at adding guard pages which were not readable, not writable. So we have another alternative for that, that we don't have to do that, we can do something else. So another thing we could do is we could say, let's put the return address on its own page, and let's use some of the other permission bits. Let's just make the return address not writable. And this will also cause a segfault. This is something we can actually do. The problem is that to change this table each time, you need to go to the OS and say, please make this readable again, please make it writable again, and you have to waste all this space. But this is a real thing you could do. And this general idea of taking these addresses of code that we tried to target and making them read-only is a good one, and something we will try to do elsewhere. Now, for the return address, this doesn't actually seem very good, because to have the return address be read-only, we are wasting 4 kilobytes on our stack, every function call. That's probably not something you're going to convince people to do, in addition to the slowness of calling the OS at the beginning and end of the function to say, make this read-only, oh, make it writable again, because I'm done. But we can think about other pointers we had. So here's a short list. So for vtable pointers, could we do this? Yes, but do you want to allocate a C object where you have 4 kilobytes to store the vtable pointer and the rest of the stuff that's writable? Probably not. We could also do this for function pointers and structs maybe, but you'd have to like annotate them and have them be set up. And if they're next to normal pointers, that's a little harder. But there's one thing we saw that it does help with, which is that my classic strategy for I have a way to write a pointer at an arbitrary location and change something, the easiest thing for me to do was to change the global offset table, where we had a list of where things were in libraries for library calls. Like, I overwrote where free was so I could make it call system instead for me and run a shell command. So wouldn't it be nice if the global offset table was just read-only? And this is something that real systems do implement. So on Linux, there's something called RelRO. For relocation read-only, I assume. And what this does is that it sets after the global offset table was set up initially, when the program loads, it makes it read-only. So now that my pointer overwrite that I did earlier just won't work. It will just segfault instead, saying you can't write to that address. So I have to find some other pointer in the program rather than these generic global offset table ones to overwrite. So basically all we're doing is we're changing that write bit in the table for where the global offset table is. And maybe we need to add a little padding to make it be on its own page. But that's probably not too much space, because the global offset table for a big program is probably about 4K anyways. Now, on Linux, this doesn't happen all the time. And the primary reason is lazy binding. So if you remember with lazy binding, we only looked up functions when we called them, and the idea is that this made loading programs a lot faster. And we could have the global offset table be read-only and do lazy binding, but we need to like make it writable whenever you look up a function and then make it readable again, only read-only again. So we could do that, but they decided not to. They decided that was too slow, and it makes sense because you're doing something which take a system call, which is like a couple of microseconds. Every single time you call a function the first time, that's going to make loading programs a lot slower. Because you call printf the first time, you call puts the first time, you call string copy the first time, and so on. Each of those takes like an extra microsecond or two. It's going to add up. Especially for programs like ls, which we run from scratch all the time. So on Linux, to have this be feature enabled, you need to disable lazy binding. And if you do that, it will actually resolve all the functions and make all the global offset table entries, and then mark it read-only. So I looked on my laptop. So Ubuntu wants to do this, but they're concerned about the performance. And about 14% of programs have decided to have it enabled. The rest don't. And I believe the primary reason for this is that it hurts performance sometimes. And that's a reason not to always have it enabled. So Stack Canaries, we got that down low enough. It's like 1 or 2 or 3%. People were happy. This can be higher for short-lived programs. At least people think so, so they don't have it turned on by default. So any questions about this mechanism? And we'll look into other things we can do with these sort of permission tricks. But this is the sort of big tool set we're going to be using. So earlier we talked about address space randomization, that painful thing you need to disable or else the overassignment gets really, really, really hard. And I'm going to talk about sort of how Linux actually implements that. So on 64-bit Linux, this is the default layout. When you run that setarc command, this is where things end up in the program. So we have our code, which is typically on 64-bit, is at this address in hex. Then we have a writable data, which is at this address, which is actually just the code address plus 2 megabytes, or whatever multiple of 2 megabytes, depending if you have more than 2 meg of code. Then you have your heap right above that. Then you have dynamic libraries at this address, which is like 1/3 of the maximum address, 2/3 of the addresses. That's why you have this funny number. And then you have the stack starting. So this is the default layout. And we saw that there's address space randomization. And the reason for that is that given this layout, you can figure out where something in a library is that you want to overwrite, even if you can't overwrite the global offset table. You can find constant addresses to overwrite. You can figure out where the stack is. And we want to stop that. So our shell code might be in a global variable. We want to know where that is. We might need to change something to be run. We want to know where that global variable or function pointer is. And we have all these fixed addresses we were relying on to make that work. And what we want to do is randomize those to make this harder. So rather than letting the attacker just know where things are on the stack, know where a global variable is, it would be really nice if, you know, assuming that the program doesn't leak the addresses somewhere, that we choose a new address every single time and make sure that there's enough possible addresses that the attacker can't make a guess and like run our program or like web server, ask it 1,000 times and eventually get it right. And this should prevent exploits because we can't figure out what to write to that code pointer we're overwriting. We can't make it equal the address of some interesting function or our machine code, because we don't know the address where our machine code is stored. So Linux implements this. And as you saw in the assignment, it's on by default. So the basic algorithm for the stack and most of the other things that are randomized work similarly is that you choose a random number from between some range on 64-bit Linux. It's about a 64, results in a 64 gigabyte range. So you choose this random number, you add, multiply it times 4K, and you subtract that from the base address of the stack. So we have this 16 gigabyte range where the stack can start. And it's a random address within that, which is aligned to, which is a multiple of 4 kilobytes. So any multiple of 4 kilobytes in that 16 gigabyte range is where the stack can be. And as an attacker, this means you're going to have a hard time guessing where something on the stack is stored. So basically, your only option for figuring out how to do stack smashing in this is to have something print out to you the address of something on the stack. Otherwise, you're just not going to be able to guess it often enough. Yeah?
So how does the OS map that to actual?
So the question is, how does the OS map into physical memory? The mapping is going to be exactly the same as if we didn't randomize. Because the way that this works, remember we have this table here, and part of the table is the real address that corresponds to a program address. So the OS can just choose the same addresses for the real address part. It just puts them in a different part of the table. Yes? So the question is, if the attacker finds out how to get the address, how do they actually turn that into an exploit? So presumably, this would be something like you have a web server, and like it prints out the address. So the typical way the exploit would work is you first you do the thing which makes the web server print out the address, then you look at that and you construct the next thing which uses that address it printed out. So you need some sort of interactivity. But for network programs, this is very common. And for other cases, it also sort of comes up. So like in a web browser, if you're writing JavaScript and you have something which gives you an address in JavaScript, you can have your JavaScript code like do a computation on that address and then do something else, which is an exploit. Which is how that, for example, when we talked about that use after free example in Chrome, that's how the real version worked, because they actually had address space randomization. So they did something that got an address, and they used that address, and again, later on, with the same exploit, and they could do this because they were writing code that the browser was running that could do it. But yes, this means that we can't just have a fixed string like your buffer overflow exploit in these cases where we have randomized addresses. So Linux does similar things for other addresses. So this is what the layout looks like with address space layout randomization. We have a random factor for the location of the stack, for the location of libraries, and some types of dynamically allocated memory, and for the location of the heap. So we have some randomization where those start. And this is how we keep attackers from guessing addresses. And on 64-bit, this is really nice because we have these huge gaps. So we have plenty of choices for these addresses. You know, we can easily have 16 gigabyte ranges of addresses in which we put the stack without having any problems. On 32-bit, this is a bit more problematic. We can't have a 16 gigabyte range of addresses because there's only 4 gigabytes of addresses total. So that's not going to be possible. And we want to leave enough space so the program can actually like allocate a gigabyte of stuff on the heap. It would be pretty embarrassing to say, you can use this technique, but then your program has to use like less than 100 meg of memory. So this is what the layout looks like for 32-bit programs on Linux with address space randomization. So there's a lot less variation in the addresses. And remember that these are always in multiples of 4K, because the OS can only deal with single pages when it allocates memory. So there's actually not as many choices. There's only like 256 choices for some of these, or even less. So this means that when you have a 32-bit system with less possible addresses, well, randomizing the addresses is less effective because there's less things for the attacker to guess. And that's just a fundamental limitation. So on 64-bit, you have like 30 bits of random information that the attacker needs to guess in order to figure out, like, to guess where their code is without an information leak. On 32-bit Linux, you have about 8. So if the attacker can try 256 times, they'll get it. On average. So you may have noticed that there was a bit of a problem with this scheme here, which we'll start on next time. And that was that I randomized these addresses, but my writable data, my code, they're constant. And that's actually a problem because my writable data contains like global variables. It might contain function pointers. That's a big target for attackers. So we're going to talk about next time why these are fixed and how we can fix that. And then fortunately, there's going to be a cost to that. That's all I have for now.